Travel around the American countryside and you notice that we mark lots of places as significant in our history. Historical markers tell stories of people who came before us and deeds they did to warrant remembering. The markers and historical sites do not often make use of terms like white supremacy and murder, but those are factors in the history of our country. A University of Oregon professor studies white supremacy in American history and notes how we tend to omit some of the uncomfortable truths about our history and the stories of the people who had to move or die to make room for the current civilization. Laura Pulido is the head of the Ethnic Studies Department at the U of O, was last year's resident scholar at the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics, and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Pulido, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this would seem to be a recurring theme in your life, your fascination with maps and what they show and the social realities that they do not show.
Yes, that is true. I am a geographer as well as an ethnic studies scholar. So I remember my fascination with maps going back to being a child, actually, and really interested in the local landscape and trying to figure it out, you know, as a young person. So I think that eventually led me to these kind of questions and work.
Did, in at least for you, did geography morph into sociology or something over time?
I did take a lot of sociology. Well, one of the things that's kind of cool about the field of geography, it's a very broad field, and that's actually one of our concerns. We're not quite sure where it ends and where sociology or anthropology might begin. But one of the things that does keep geography anchored is an attention to place, space, as well as relationships about around the environment. And those have always just been really core interests for me.
Okay, I do remember those maps as a kid. I was thinking about the fact that it goes beyond just knowing where the rivers and the peaks are, but also like what agricultural
yes.
products come from places and stuff like that. And as you get further into what people do on the landscape, it turns into something other than just landforms.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And so I understand when you're asking about sociology, it's like that's actually what I foreground in many ways, kind of the social relations that people engage in that and ultimately result in maps or that maps seek to represent. But there's a whole lot that goes into that and a whole lot of questions and assumptions that need unpacking.
Let's talk about some of your past work so people can get an idea of where you come from. Tell us about, for example, the People's Guide to Los Angeles.
So I'm a native Angeleno, and I loved my city of the Angels very, very much. And I was doing a book, actually, one time looking at activism in Los Angeles, stories, activists from the 60s and 70s, particularly among African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and Japanese-Americans. And I was hearing their stories. They were telling me, like, oh, on this corner, we used to have these protests. On this corner, we had a police raid. On this corner, we had a food co-op. And I realized, well, this is kind of like a completely unknown geography of the city. So I began kind of collecting these sites, these lists of places that people were telling me about. And eventually a friend said, well, you should put them together and call it A People's Guide to Los Angeles. And I thought, that's a great idea. And so that's exactly what I did. I worked with some of my former students, Laura Bearclaw and Wendy Chang. And we put a tour guide together. So it looks like an actual tour guide. And what it does, it not only documents this kind of radical history, it foregrounds sites of racial, class, gender, and environmental struggle in Los Angeles' history and landscape, but we also use it as a vehicle to show people how to read and understand the power relations embedded in the urban landscape, which is something most people don't typically think about. We just think about what is there, and that's what it is. But there's really, really deep histories and stories about power and contestation and struggle about how a place got to be how it is. And so that's what we try to do in that. And when I was doing that, I focused on these unknown kind of sites. But in the process of doing that, I also realized there's many, many formal sites that are formally recognized by the state or by local communities. And I became very interested thinking about, well, what are those stories that I'm not looking at? Because I was kind of dismissing them as, oh, that's all known stuff. But with time, I really got to think, no, that's actually a really important way of understanding how the state operates by what it chooses to commemorate, why, who we commemorate, who we don't commemorate, and what are the stories that we tell.
Did you find much overlap? I mean, is there a lot of, was there some crossover between the sites that people were raving about as places that were important to the history of Los Angeles and places that were officially documented as such?
There was a little.
A little.
There was a little, not a lot. Not a lot, yeah. But I am happy to say that since the book came out, it came back out a while ago, 2012 or so, I know there have been numerous efforts to on the part, particularly of like immigrant communities, communities of color, to begin getting some of those sites memorialized also and protected by the state. So I know that has kind of been impetus for different organizations doing that work. And I think some groups like the Los Angeles Conservancy, which is a city, it's not part of the formal state, but it works very closely. They have also begun recognizing, oh, there's a problem with what we are commemorating because it overwhelmingly kind of celebrates the architecture of great white men, as well as the stories of great white men. So there really has been an effort to begin thinking more broadly about it, which I think is really great.
Laura Pulido is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the head of the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Oregon. She's a geographer. She is obviously in ethnic studies as well. And we're talking about where we commemorate our history and how we do that, something that's an ongoing theme in her work. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about the places that we choose as representative of our history and the places we don't, for that matter. And then when we do choose them, what we say about them. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this is a rich landscape, particularly when you take it outside of a city like Los Angeles. I mean, it seems like it's almost boundless that things happened across the landscape that were not commemorated, or perhaps are commemorated in ways that aren't completely fair to the other people who were involved.
Yes, that is true. That is true. Since moving to Oregon, I really began thinking about the U.S. as a whole, not just a particular, you know, Los Angeles or California, but thinking about the U.S. as a whole. And so that's what led me to think about sites on the National Register of Historic Places, which is a list of sites that many people can and do nominate sites. And there's about 90,000 of them actually in the United States today. Sites on the National Register, which are thought to have some kind of significant value. It could be architecture, it could be history, it could be, I have 33 different categories in which something could be significant.
So, well, for 90,000, that's a whole bunch of places. So
that's a lot.
But as I mentioned a moment ago in setting up for callers to join us, it's not just about the places that are commemorated, but there are lots of places that aren't.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. There's lots of places that aren't. And frankly, from the way I think any place could be commemorated, it's, you know, it's what you choose is significant about that place. And then it takes a lot of effort and labor and a certain level kind of expertise in learning how to deal with bureaucracies to get a site nominated on the site. But like here I am at the University of Oregon, there's at least two buildings that are national landmarks on our campus. And my guess is you're down in Southern Oregon, and there's probably sites there as well. Campuses are really good at doing that kind of thing. So, but really, if you think about what is commemorated, those are the people who tend to have, first, the time and energy and resources to do it. And then, B, they tend to overwhelmingly be urban sites throughout the United States because that's where most people are, and that's where most people identify sites that are quote significant. So automatically more rural sites kind of get neglected by the urban. The weight of the urban really carries the day on that. And then within that, there's another set of kind of motivating factors that people that want their, particularly, I think probably like West, different parts of the country, I think it's probably a little bit different. You know, for places like in Oregon, it's very much affirming a particular kind of pioneer heritage and narrative about the founding of Oregon as a part of the United States. So right away, we see an emphasis on sites that are after the site becomes part of a territory and then a state versus earlier sites involving perhaps indigenous people, although there are a few of those here in Oregon and other places as well. So there's real immediate biases that go into creating what kind of sites might even be considered. And then you have to go through a nomination process of convincing the National Park Service or other entities that this, in fact, merits inclusion on the list.
So, Laura, what's the approach you're taking in research then? Are you looking at pretty much all the historical sites within a radius of Eugene or something? And then what beyond that?
So what I'm doing is I was going to look at a subset of sites on the National Register of Historic Places, which would have brought me down from 90,000 sites down to 40,000 sites. And I was looking at sites early on from 1513, and that date is significant. That's when the first European Ponce de Leon arrived in what is now Florida, over into 1898. And that's significant because that's when Hawaii, the Organic Act, and Hawaii becomes part of the United States. So it kind of finishes the map of the United States in conventional terms. But I decided, again, that's still too big. So then one of my students suggested, why don't we just focus on national landmarks, which are, again, a subset of sites on the National Register of Historic Places. And that is about 2,600 sites. So it's way more feasible. And I thought it captured the same dynamics because it's a more curated subset that, again, the U.S. has decided these are really important sites in terms of our national heritage. And that's the language that they use in terms of the heritage of the United States. And that could be, it's primarily a lot of architecture, but also, you know, social history, political history, as well as environmental or landscape sites. So like the Columbia Highway is one of those sites, you know, on the list of national landmarks. So I'm looking at this list and we're kind of creating a database, which will be publicly available. And we're coding the different sites in terms of when were they created, where are they, what do they represent. So we're doing all that basic kind of data. And then we're also looking at the nomination materials that kind of serves as our archive. And we're looking to what extent does it include different types of white supremacy that might that are went into the creation of the site. And so we identified five or six different forms of white supremacy. So those include colonization, settler colonization, slavery, state formation, nation building, and empire. And when I say empire, I'm talking about the U.S. empire abroad, but there's a surprisingly number of sites that actually commemorate the U.S. empire abroad that are within the 50 states themselves, these different kinds of sites. So we're looking how it is, what identifying what were those different kinds of relationships or social relations went into producing the site, and then how is that acknowledged, to what extent, if at all, is it acknowledged, right? And then I'm choosing a smaller subset of those to go do field work at those sites. And eventually, I hope to produce a historical atlas. And right now, and I need a better name, but I'm calling it the Historical Atlas of White Supremacy. So it'll be both a digital and hopefully a hard copy book. And hopefully it's a tool to get the people in the United States to get a more, I think, an accurate understanding of how this country developed and the stories that we choose to tell about how the story developed and kind of looking at, in some ways, the misalignment between the two of them.
Laura Pulido is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She has the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Oregon. And as you heard, she's working on a historical atlas of white supremacy based in Oregon to take a look at the places that we choose to remember our history and how we choose to remember our history. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join the conversation by phone, you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You moved quickly on to talking about empire, but I believe you also said state formation. So formation of the state of Oregon, you think, is an act of white supremacy in itself?
I want to clarify something you said. I'm not looking at the state, just the state of Oregon. I'm looking at the United States as a whole.
Okay, sorry. Okay.
Which that would include, of course, the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I say the U.S. state, so I'm looking at primarily the federal government, but not exclusively. So yes, I am also looking, if those sites pop up on the list that refer to the local, to the individual state. So it could be the state of Oregon. And yes, one could absolutely argue that the creation of the state of Oregon is an act of white supremacy. I define white supremacy as a set of acts, beliefs and acts that really come from the idea that white people and places, such as here, are superior to non-white people and places. And that's a very broad definition. And I want to acknowledge as many different forms of white supremacy. So a lot of people think of white supremacy today as, you know, violence or hate crimes, you know, these kinds of things. And those certainly are. I don't want to pretend like they're not. But I think the vast majority of acts of white supremacy are really emanating from the belief that white people are more of greater value than indigenous and non-white people. And because they're of greater value, their needs, preferences, and desires all come first. So one could argue that in the case of Oregon, the fact that this is a settler state, and we have, you know, certainly evidence of this on the part of different empires, not just, you know, what we call the United States today, but in a part of England and the French and Spanish and other empires at the time in colonial forces, they clearly thought that their needs and desires were more important than that of Native people. In terms of different forms of conquest that occurred, you know, certainly throughout the United States, one looks at that, and it's quite, when you look at the maps, like for example of land secessions and takings, you have to think what's going on there. And I'm not arguing again that they are driven primarily, we're doing this because we're white supremacists. I don't think that's the case at all. I think white supremacy is an enabling logic that helps facilitate different kinds of political, religious projects, economic projects, if you will. But there always has to be, when the displacement or the killing is so great, you need some kind of ideology to do that. And that is where the white supremacy comes in. It becomes an enabling logic to allow you to achieve a particular kind of particular objective, whatever that might be. So in the case of slavery, I don't think black people were enslaved because there was, we want to go get them and hurt those people. No, we were interested in a very clear economic project, and we employed white supremacy in order to justify the taking of people and bringing them as chattel slaves to work in our fields, you know.
All right, so slavery, homicide, genocide don't have to be present. It's just the idea that our culture is superior to yours. We're going to put it here, and yours has to leave or do something.
I don't even think about culture. It's about people. Mm-hmm. I mean, culture is part of it, you're right, but it's actually about bodies. The whole idea of settler colonization is about replacement. Mm-hmm. We will replace you. We will take over this land, right? Yes.
Laura Pulido, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the head of the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Oregon, the resident scholar for last academic year at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics, working with students on a historical atlas of white supremacy, looking at national landmarks across the country. Join the conversation as we talk about this somewhat thorny issue. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned in passing the Columbia River Highway. Are there other examples you can give us where people know the place and might not know the full story?
Let's see. Are you talking about in Oregon?
But just an example generally of a place where you can recommend either a change in how the site is represented or a site that may not be represented at all at this point.
I can do that. There's I went last spring to Fort Clatsop in Astoria. And this is on the National Register of Historic Places. And this is the site where Lewis and Clark wintered. I think it was in 05, 06. They wintered. They had made it all the way to the coast, and then they were going to head back, you know, towards Missouri. And it's really a very elaborate site run by the National Park Service, and they have recreated the actual fort there. And I thought it was a very interesting telling that goes on. Here, especially in Oregon, we're very committed to the stories of Lewis and Clark, as we should be, because they're incredibly important stories. And they have a little museum there, and they have a section there that talk about the native peoples of the area. And they have, like, their canoes, their hats, and all these artifacts from the past. And I think that's very interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it casts native people strictly as historical in the history in the past, right? And we know, especially here in the case of Oregon, that, you know, Native people are alive and well. But so that's an interesting thing, how they're cast in the past. And then secondly, there's never any recognition of what happened to the Native people. So how did that place, Fort Astoria, come to be Oregon, come to be part of the United States? And that's what I see is missing most systematically through most sites. It's the mechanism of displacement, at least when it comes to Native people. We don't know what happened. I was just in Pearl Harbor, for example, last week. I was in Hawaii for the American Studies Conference. And in Pearl Harbor, they talk about, you know, of course, all the things that happened there. It's very greatly detailed what happened. And then they have one small plaque that says, in 1893, the Kingdom of Hawaii was overthrown. Well, you never hear who overthrew it, for what purposes. How did they overthrow it, right? I mean, there's a whole story to that, a really, really big one, but that is completely left off the table. So those are one of the omissions that I really see that we need to be thinking about, is that mechanism of displacement. It's too uncomfortable for us to talk about, so we don't. We just erase it.
So how do you work through that defense, though, of discomfort? I mean, the fact is that, you know, you get a lot of people going to say, well, I'm not a white supremacist, and neither were my relatives. But, I mean, the fact is you're making a case that white supremacy, more broadly defined, leads to things like settling in places where people already live.
Yes, it does. How would you argue otherwise?
So how do you overcome the defenses, though? I mean, of the people who
right.
they'd rather not deal with the discomfort.
That's right. It is. Well, this is something that I frankly think the United States has avoided dealing with for centuries. All right. We tell ourselves a particular story about how we came to be, you know, and the whole struggle. And it's going to be a very painful process. People will feel uncomfortable. But we have to move to a greater honest account of what happened. And in some ways, I understand that white supremacy, it just, at some point, it may just, I can't deal with that. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to, like, not engage. And that's a, you know, that's certainly a critique to be made about my work. But it also, I'm trying to provide a tool for people to begin seeing, because I think this is going to take generations. That's what I think, right? For people to come to an honest account of the telling of the story. And that's going to be a very painful and difficult thing, because it's going to, in some ways, shake the nation to the core when we get to the point of actually addressing what happened. Because our story, what happened, is very, very incomplete, to say the least. It's untrue. It's a very partial truth. And to create a nation that can move forward, you're going, and to actually ever have racial justice, you have to come to grips with the truth. So it's going to be a very hard one, and there will be lots of difficult feelings, shall we say, big feelings, is what I tell my kids, right? You know, in terms of recognizing. And I don't want people to get stuck in guilt, because it's not helpful just to blame your ancestors, think I'm not the white supremacist, right? These are much larger kind of social relations that have characterized empires, that have characterized state colonial forces for centuries. And we have to acknowledge that. And most importantly, we have to see how it shapes the present, mm-hmm. All right? And if you're stuck in a position of guilt, although that's not me, you can't get to the place of thinking, how does this affect the present? And that's what we really need to do. We have to reckon with the past to see how it shapes now and how we want to move forward.
All right. Laura Pulido, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the historical atlas of white supremacy in its early stages now from the Ethnic Studies Department at the U of O. Thanks again for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.